Hey everybody, this is DJ Q for the Golf News Met Radio Network. We now return you to Jay's Place, already in progress.
Alright, thank you DJ Q for bringing us back from break. I am Jay Flama of the Golf News Net Radio Network, and you are listening to the Jay's Play Show. So glad to have everybody back. We are back here with Steve Smyers, golf course architect and president of the American Society of Golf Course Architects. And Jay's Plays is brought to you by our brand new sponsor, JB's Best Hot Sauce. And that means it's time for the JB's Best Hot Sauce trivia question. All right, Steve, this is the part of the show where I get to ask you a trivia question, and you get to see if you can get it right. And if you do, you win a bottle of hot sauce from JB's, and you win a free JB's t-shirt.
First off, I love JB's hot sauce. I'm a hot sauce. I put hot sauce on everything I eat. JB's is my favorite.
I am so glad to hear you say that, okay? And here's the thing, everybody. I'm kind of like Bob Kraft. Okay, remember that old thing where he used to say, I liked it so much I bought the company? He bought the razor company, Gillette. Well, I'm the same way, okay? If I really, 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 really like something, then I'll want it to be a sponsor. You know, it's not like if somebody could just call me up and be like, yeah, will you sponsor my stuff? Well, it's got to work. It's got to be good, you know? It has to be something I like and I'll use. And I'm like you, okay? I put hot sauce on everything except cereal. So, and we were really astonished at the remarkable flavor that this hot sauce has. It tastes like a wing sauce, a buffalo wing sauce. But it's got wonderful spices. Your savory glands are just in overload mode when you take a taste of it. So, and the best thing about it is it's designed by a former golf writer. It's designed by John Burma. You know, this is his dream after he stopped writing for the PGA of America, and now he makes one of the best hot sauces in the country. So here we go. Here's a trivia question. Are you ready?
Okay.
That's not the trivia question. That's the preliminary question. Here comes the trivia question. Right, since it is Super Bowl week, our trivia question is going to be Super Bowl related. And you will get two different chances to get this question correct and win the bottle of hot sauce. You can either guess the score, or you can guess the two teams involved in what Super Bowl it was. But the question is, what was the lowest scoring first half in Super Bowl history, and by whom?
Jay, I can't remember what I did yesterday, let alone that. I should know that, but I'm gonna get it over with quick. I don't know.
Are you sure you can't think back into the day? Okay, who would have had a defensive struggle?
Baltimore when I don't know what's the thing.
Do you want to take a wild stab at the score?
No, you go ahead and do it. I give up.
Well, okay, we would have to go all the way back to Super Bowl IX between the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Minnesota Vikings. The first time the Steelers won the Super Bowl, the score at the end of the first half was 2-0. They sat Fran Tarkington in the end zone for a safety, and that was all the scoring in the first half. So, and as you know, the Steelers went on to win that Super Bowl 16-6, and then rattled off three more in 5 years. The beginning of the Steeler dynasty. Some very interesting factoids about that Super Bowl. Okay, Chuck Knoll was such a straight-laced, you know, teetotaler that when his wife came down after the game ended, instead of hugging her, he shook her hand. I mean, that's such a Chuck Knoll thing to do. The Steelers said that he was so quiet and so stoic, you know. But that the one time that he did open his mouth, they all wanted to go right through the wall for him. And of course, it had to do with their hated rival, the Raiders, okay?
Right
before the Steelers played the AFC Championship game against the Raiders. You recall the Raiders played the Dolphins, and they beat the Dolphins on a last-second touchdown, 28-26, to get the right to host the Steelers in the AFC Championship game. And John Madden said after the game, he goes, what a game, the two best teams in football are at it. Well, before the game between Pittsburgh and Oakland, Chuck Knoll went up to his team, and they were wondering, what is he going to say, because he doesn't normally talk. He held up that newspaper column, and he said, the best team in football is right here. And Joe Green, mean Joe Green, said, I wanted to go bite through the wall into the enemy locker room. That's how psyched up mean Joe Green was. All right, well, have your things. Let's talk a little bit about the Super Bowl that's coming up right now. The Panthers are anywhere from a 4.5 to 6-point favorite. I got in very early. I got the Panthers when they were only a 4-point favorite. So when I do a teaser with the over-under, I actually get to take the Panthers and 2 points and over 39.5, which I think is a pretty good bet. But what do you think about this Super Bowl?
You know, I'm emotionally tied to Peyton Manning. I've always been a fan of his. He's a mad golfer. I played golf with him up in Indianapolis. He played at a course. I did two courses in Indianapolis, and one was for a gentleman in his backyard on his estate, and Peyton used to go out there and play. And the other one was Wolf Run in Indianapolis, my first project. And he's a mad golfer. He's a great guy. And, he's always risen to the occasion, even though, the Panthers are just an unbelievable team.
It would be a nice bookend for him to get to and Eli to get to. It seems like, that this is going to be his swan song and the stage is set up for him to say one more long farewell.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing about it is this could possibly be the reverse of 2 years ago. Remember, the Broncos were going to supposedly destroy the Seahawks and they got blown out. Now all the conventional wisdom is the Panthers are going to blow out the Broncos. You know, I'm starting to have second thoughts about my pick on one thing and one thing only. I'm not going to change it because I made it. I stick with it. But there is one way that Denver can win this football game, and that is by just playing better defense than the Carolina Panthers do. The Panthers offense is good, but they're not that good. They blew out a team in Arizona that broke hard and jagged. And they had to hang on for dear life against Seattle, even though they scored those 31 points in the first half. That's not what a dominant winning championship team does. You put the hammer down and you finish somebody. Yeah, they did it against Arizona, but this is the best defense that they're going to face all year. Now, the problem is the offense, though. That's the only thing that has me worried is that Peyton, he's tied up together with popsicle sticks and duct tape and spit and heart. And that may not be enough to get the job done. But I'm going to take the Panthers in the over. What about you? You're going to take the Broncos and?
I'll do the over as well.
Yeah, it could be a shootout. So now, what are you going to do for your Super Bowl party?
I'm going to lead a boring life. I'm going to be traveling from out to California for the golf industry show.
Nothing like spending a beautiful California day walking around indoors under a big, big top tent.
That's it. I'm going to miss a lot of it there.
That's one of the reasons my friends ask me, how come I don't go to the PGA show, and when I do, I don't hang out much in the exhibition tents. It's like, I remind you of the immortal words of Brian Silva, okay, when the American Society of Golf Course Architects was having their annual meeting 1 year at Monterey Peninsula Country Club, and Brian was telling me the story about how you guys were going to be discussing what the definition of the term shot value should be. And you sat there for 3 hours and nobody come to any sort of an agreement whatsoever. And somebody had the brains to look outside the window and say, you know what? It's a gorgeous day. This is a phenomenal golf course. What are we doing? Let's get out of here and go play. That's how I feel anytime I'm walking around any one of those, whether it's South by Southwest. I love you guys in Austin. I really do. Okay. But, seriously, walking around trading cards and looking at, the latest, greatest gadget I'm not going to use. It's just not my idea of fun when it could be out playing. But
there you go.
So speaking of the ASGCA, I understand that you have got a lot of great plans in mind and that you're working together well with the U.S. Chancellor Initiative. So give us a lowdown of what it is that you're working on.
Well, the USGA is doing some very, very creative things. You know, and one of the things that they're doing right now is they're focusing all their wherewithal, their expertise, their knowledge, their resources into helping facilities, mainly daily fee facilities, making them more sustainable from a financial perspective. So the ASGCA has partnered with the USGA, or the USGA has asked us to partner with them, going to facilities around the country. These facilities can write and ask for grants that we will have one of our members from our organization, along with the USGA Green Section, go to their facility, take a site visit with all the powers to be of the club, and make recommendations to that club or to that facility to make improvements, either architecturally, agronomically, or both, to help that facility become more of a profitable entity, more of a viable entity. And that is, we just announced that effort the first of last month. We've had a tremendous response to it. So I think this is something that the USGA is doing for the good of the game and for golf facilities around the country, and we're happy to be their partner in this endeavor, in this effort.
What are the keys to financial and agronomic sustainability?
Well, you know, the big thing is water. Water is a big, big, big issue, not only in the United States, but around the world. So we have to conserve water. We have to cut back on our water usage, which means we conserve water. We cut down on the amount of turf reduction, the amount of maintainable turf on a golf course. And by cutting back on water, that would cut back on electricity, which is, in so many places, is a very big part of the maintenance budget. So if we want to be more environmentally sustainable and more economically sustainable, those are the major areas that we're cutting back on right now and trying to conserve.
One of my favorites is Fast and Firm Conditions and Biscuit Brown in color. How do we get the mainstream rank-and-file golf fan, especially the public golfer, to become more enamored with Biscuit Brown when all they see on television is finely manicured Augusta Green?
Well, you know, Jay, this is one of the things, when I was on the executive committee, this is one of the things that we addressed. And if you'll notice, a lot of the only way people are going to start accepting this is through seeing this in championships. And I think the USGA has done a very good job of previewing this at both Chambers Bay and Pinehurst. And you're going to see it at Erin Hills as well in 2017. Oakmont will be this year in 2016. And you're going to see this at the championships. And I think that's going to start gravitating down through the general golfing public. They'll start accepting this. It's going to take time, but it is the way of the future. And I think that people will start accepting it as we move forward.
Well, I hope so. I know that we got some blowback last year. Everyone genuflected and told us how beautiful and how wonderful it was at Pinehurst. You know, and we all kind of looked the other way. Every time somebody took a divot, there was a cloud of dust that popped up out of the air. But at Chambers Bay, it got vilified a little bit. You know, almost as a bit of a double standard, that it was okay to have it at a 100-year-old Donald Ross course, but it wasn't okay to have it at a 7-year-old Robert Trent Jones course. There were some really minor things that I thought people were picky about, but if you want to criticize them, fine. You know, yes, the golf course was a tough walk, especially for the fans, but also it had its own unique character. Every one of those holes being so memorable. But what concerned me was that it seemed like we almost took a bit of a step back on the broadcast, that people didn't embrace it as much as they could have. And I agree with you, though. I thought Chambers Bay acquitted itself beautifully and that it should be coming back into the rotation sooner rather than later.
You know, everything that happened last year was about change. And, you know, we're all used to very many different things. We're all used to, ABC did a great job for many years, and then we did a different type of broadcast. And, it was a different type of golf course. And, you know, we're not ready to accept change. When Pete Dye first built the PPC course in Jacksonville, people very much criticized it and said, that because it was so much out of the ordinary. And now 35 years later, they think it's one of the great stops on the PGA Tour, the TPC at Jacksonville. So it just takes time for people to get used to things, that's all.
Now, you bring up a great point when you mentioned Pete Dye. I'm going to ask you a hard question now, but a thoughtful question. I want to see if we can together possibly puzzle out a good answer. Why is it that Pete Dye's never had one of his courses host a U.S. Open? He's had five PGA championships, but he's never once had a U.S. Open. I think I might know. I'm curious to see if your reason might agree with mine.
Okay, go ahead. You go first.
Well, go ahead. No, you go first. I got to hear what your reason is.
He's hosted a lot of major championships. They've had a lot of USGA competitions on his golf courses. But the Open has gone to very traditional golf courses up until a couple of years ago. So, his time hasn't happened yet, but maybe it will be in the future. And,
much of it too is
accommodating outside of the ropes. Outside the playability aspect of it. And a lot of Pete's courses host PGA events. And USGA doesn't necessarily, they want to have their own identifiable product out there.
I noticed something last year. Every time the PGA Championship goes to a Pete Dye golf course, the place gets torched. I love Pete. I love the fact that he's one of our generation's great champions in McDonald, Rainer, and Banks. I love that you can count out your angles. He's one of the great geometric designers there is. Lines and charm everywhere. He's a funny guy and a good guy. And his courses look terrifying. But I noticed that when the pros get there for a major, they eat the place alive. Especially last year when they dismembered Whistling Straits to the tune of 20 under. I mean, that is supposed to be a hard golf course. So how come Pete hasn't yet, he makes them look so hard, but not play so hard? For the pros, at least.
Yeah, the game has changed tremendously through the years. And the game of angles for the modern day professional isn't what it used to be. It's more about the strategy of the game has changed so much at an elite level. It is about intelligent driving of the golf ball these days. So the fairways have to become a little more, tee shot has to become a little more exacting. The pros, it's all about controlling the spin. If they're hitting in a fairway, a wide fairway, it doesn't matter what angle they have. As long as they're able to control the spin, because the grasses are so good and the lies are so good right now and the equipment's so good that they, as long as they can control the spin, the angles don't mean as much to them.
So how do you balance out making a course easy enough for the average player to get around, yet tough enough to challenge the very best golfers?
You know,
what's the keys to you being able to succeed?
It's a very, very easy equation. I have something that everybody refuses to accept, but you know, the average, just think of it this way, the average swing speed on tour is 112 miles an hour, which equates to 270 yards in the air. And the average tour player, hits the fairway, the average fairways hit on tour is 62%. And then the real differentiation, the real factor that differentiates the pros on tour, there's two factors. One, the distance into the green from 160 to 220 yards. That's the first factor. Then the second factor is proximity to the pin from the proximity to the pin. And there's a huge difference in proximity to the pin hitting from the fairway as opposed to hitting from the rough. And when people think of rough, they think of rough as big, deep, 3 inches rough. Well, the difference for people with a high swing speed, a touring pro, is just to have enough rough to cover the equator of the golf ball. And if you can have that factor in, if they miss the fairway, you just put an emphasis on them driving the golf ball in the fairway, and you have enough length in the golf holes where it's going to require someone who flies at 270 yards in the air to have a 160-yard shot into the green, 160 to 220 yards. And the real difference is if they just miss it just in the rough, they have a harder time controlling. It's all about spin. They have a harder time controlling it out of the rough. So you just factor those two equations in, and that's the way that you keep the pros. That's the way you identify the person who's playing the best golf. So I think that's going to be kind of the wave of the future. And I think that Marion, when the U.S. Open was at Marion, that is a perfect formula. They talk about Marion being a short golf course. And when you think about
it. Oh, no, it's not at all. There's some very long golf holes there.
Marion is a very long golf course with some short holes.
Yeah.
So I think,
more short holes than you normally see at a U.S. Open golf course. There's three or four short ones as opposed to one.
They have, you know, par three that was 113 yards.
Phil Mickelson the tournament.
That murdered Mickelson in the tournament. And then you have a series of, you know, you have a stretch of four or five very short par fours in there. So Marion was a very long golf course. And the point is that Marion was a wonderful blend of long and short holes. And it had, though the rough was punitive, the fairways still required accurate ball striking.
Wasn't the key to Marion also, though, the fact that the greens are smaller and that the fairways dogleg in awkward places? So positioning is most important. And there's a lot of uneven lies. So you can be in the middle of the fairway, but you just don't have time because your ball's above your feet or below your feet.
The fairway, that's what I was going to say, the fairway contouring is absolutely critical. That's what keeps a player off balance right there. And so you have great fairway contouring, and you have the contouring in and around the putting surface to match the contouring of the fairways. That will challenge the most elite players. And then of course, you know, you've got to, and like you say, it's making them shape their shots to take advantage of the shape of the fairways, the grass line of the fairways. So all that is something that will, and it's not penal. It's for an elite player. It absolutely stimulates them to hit those type of shots. And that's why Marion identified one of the best ball strikers who's ever lived in Justin Rose.
Excellent point there, yes.
I think that that is, I mean, I think that is a very, very, I mean, it's a simple answer, but it's a complex situation to put together when you're putting together a piece of property. But that's exactly, and then it's very easy to design that type of golf course for the average player. You make sure that they play from their proper set of tees, hitting out, and then it's not a penal type of golf course. It's a strategic type of golf course. So as long as the average player can manage to think their way around the golf course, which they should be able to do, then they can easily negotiate that type of golf course.
Steve, it's been fantastic talking to you. I'm so sorry that we're out of time, but I'm looking very much forward to catching you out on the road sometime this year. Where are you looking forward to most playing this year?
You know, Jay, I've got a couple nice events lined up, but nothing for sure. I'm going to go back to Butterfield and play in their Butterfield Invitational. And maybe back to Olympia Fields, of course I did, which just hosted the U.S. Amateur last year. Maybe go back and play in their Invitational as well. They're better ball. They've got a real nice better ball, man.
Maybe I'll run into you at the U.S. Open and we'll get a chance to play at Oakmont, or perhaps if you come to New York, we'll have a chance to play Baltusrol before the PGA Championship.
Okay, that sounds great, Jay. Thanks for having
everybody,
me.
Thank you all for tuning into the show. It's great having Steve on the show. I am Jay Flemma of the Golf News Net Radio Network. We'll catch you all next time on Jay's Plays. We're at the end of another great Jay's Plays show, but thank you all so much for joining in. It's no fun doing this to an empty room, but it sure is fun doing it for all of you guys, so thanks so much. I want to thank Fish for kindly letting me use their great music as the theme song for the show. Thanks, guys. I want to thank CyberGolf and Golf News Network, cybergolf.com/writerscorner. You can read me and all the other fine writers, and thegolfnewsnet.com/radio. Take us home, DJ Q.
Tune in next time for another great Jay's Play show on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
Thanks, guys. Catch y'all next time.